Powderfinger, internationalist album, in the words of those great Australian philosophers, Little River Band, happy anniversary, baby.
Oh, thanks,
G'day, Phil.
Phil.
How are you, mate?
20 years, where did that go?
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Good question.
Yeah, very good question. It's been good.
Yeah, of course.
Straight to my liver.
Well, if we get
to your to your golf handicap, isn't it?
Yeah.
What was it about this particular album that made it so important, do you think?
I think for us it was the first record we all had different influences over our, you know, growing up listening to music. And I think this record we had a studio where we could record daily and sort of leave the end of the day with the song sort of tracked or played and listened back to it, which is pretty exciting. There wasn't a really long process like the records previous. So I think that felt pretty special. And the fact that we're all bringing music in and showing our influences and sort of having a pretty open attitude towards what we were writing at the time.
This, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, was your first outing with Nick DeDia, who since has become almost the sixth member of Powderfinger, and of course closely aligned with you with a lot of other stuff as well. Was that the first time you'd worked with him?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And what was it that he brought to the band that you hadn't had previously?
Yeah, well, look, Nick brought probably a little bit of focus to a band at that point who were up for anything, up for trying anything, like sort of JC was talking about. There were no real kind of rules with our songwriting at that point. We were just wanted to write and capture something that had the raw feel of whatever was happening in the band room. And I think Nick's job at that point was to kind of facilitate that and to guide, just to subtly guide, because for Nick, he was kind of just working his way into the producer role, because he'd been mix engineer and tracking engineer on Pearl Jam and Springsteen and all of these kind of big records. But this was a chance for him to start guiding the ship. So for us,
was it experimental for him as well in that case, do you think?
Well, I mean, look, it wasn't a total experiment for him because he knew what he was doing. He was very well versed in the studio. So we all kind of went down the road together, I suppose. Nick just brought the sides of the road in a little bit where necessary. God, my metaphors are still, fellas.
They're still great.
Still as fortune cookie as ever.
Yeah, mate.
But would he have taken you away from what you essentially thought was the guitar direction that you needed to take with every album and perhaps introduced you to ideas of string arrangements and things like that, which maybe previously you hadn't been open to?
No, that was already that was our idea. So we kind of really completed the demos for Internationalist and sent them to Nick. And he and I have been talking about this recently. We actually have a recording studio together now. So we're still working together. But he was telling me that he had this, you know, his manager had sent him this CD from this band from Australia, and he had it sitting on the shelf for ages, and he was like, oh yeah, I'm going to get to that. Yeah. And his manager kept ringing him, you know, 2 weeks later. He's like, have you listened to it yet? And he's like, yeah, yeah, I'll get to it. It took about a month, and then he put it on finally, and The Day You Come was the first song that he heard, and he was like, oh, I've missed this. I'm going to have missed out on this for sure. They're going to be gone to another producer.
Right.
And at that point, we were just still waiting to hear back from him, I think. Mm. So he was really excited to work with us as well, you know, at that point. So for him, it was, I mean, he has the same sense of adventure that we do in terms of he was up for coming to Australia to make a record, you know.
Yeah.
There's what we found in America actually was how insular a lot of the people in the music industry were. They weren't interested in getting around the world. Mm. I mean, that was a big motivation for us.
Yeah. Sure.
Was going everywhere we could and experiencing as much as we could.
And so
I think the main thing Nick taught us was probably to listen really, really closely to what we were doing and to be much more nuanced in. So we had the general ideas there already, but he was able to say to us, okay, the important thing is leaving stuff out of this. Use as few ideas as possible rather than add ideas.
On the subject of the relentless touring as well, had you come back reinvigorated? Were you still having fun? Were you refreshed from the experiences that you'd learnt that you took into the studio with you?
Yeah, I think we, with Double Allergic and we were getting some radio play on Triple M and other stations, I think there was a confidence around the band as well. We'd been on tour with You and My I think their Hi-Fi Way Express tour was on. So we did a national tour on that, and then we did our own tour. So off the back of that, I think the band was in a sort of pretty confident situation where I think we sort of were backing ourselves a bit more than we had previously. So I think going into the writing process and then the recording process, that really helped us to have that confidence to try things and to not get caught up on some stuff that we used to get caught up on. And, you know, Nick was obviously, as the guy said, always facilitated that in the perfect way that he would make sure that the basic song was right and the beds were right, and then we could have a bit of fun later. Mm. That's how I remember feeling at the time.
We were having an awesome time on the road then too. Mm. I mean, it was because we had some audiences that were kind of recognising our songs, and especially like you were saying about that Uptight Express tour, I think it was,
yeah,
that we did with UMI. We were playing to big rooms for the first time of, you know, 1,500 people or something like that, and it was cranking.
Mm.
And we were having a ball. I remember we got gin on our rider for the first time. And we used to
bad gin.
We used to slap the bottle of gin and say, "Naughty, naughty bottle of gin. You're a bad, bad gin." And it would be gone by about three songs into UMI's set. Right. So we were just running amok and having an awesome time. Mm. We were really confident, I think, because of that, because we had all that support from the audiences, and that fed into the writing, and then it fed into the recording process. And because we were so enthusiastic, we were in the rehearsal room every day, probably 5 days a week, and we were doing it all day. So we were kind of, we'd clicked into another gear, I reckon. We started to improve really quickly after that.
And we
wasn't arduous. It wasn't arduous.
No,
it was just a lot of fun, and a lot of things were happening very quickly. Yeah. And we wouldn't get bogged down. I think previously we used to get bogged down on songs. We'd just move on to another song and come back, and then we'd go and play cricket, and you'd cop a couple in the nuts and at lunchtime, and then we'd go back into the room.
So. JC was very vulnerable to the in-swinger to the nuts.
Yeah, well, that explains a lot of experiences for him down the track, which obviously we haven't got time to go into. The other thing I really like about this album, before we start playing it, is the album cover as well, which is a really haunting thing. It's almost Mona Lisa-esque, because you've got, it's both, just to look at it, it's hard to say, it's visually a very interesting image that you've got there of both fear and hope is perhaps one way I would explain the expression on the face of the person on the cover there. But could tell me about the cover of the album.
Who did that artwork?
It was Kevin Wilkins, right?
It was Kevin Wilkins.
Was it Kevin?
Yeah, he did that first one.
Yeah, right.
I remember Odyssey with Kevin. But, go Burn, if you like.
I was just going to say that you're right about that that neutral expression that the kid had on the kid or the man. That was the beauty of that image was that it was really hard to pin down.
It's androgynous I think.
Mm. Yeah, that's is. Right. It is. And also, it doesn't look quite as propaganda, like communist propaganda, as the following images in the artwork do, where there's the woman who's the worker in the hayfield, and there's a spaceman, and there's one more. I can't remember what the other one is. But that idea, I mean, Internationalist was, the title itself was actually kind of a bit of a play on what was going on in Australia and all the nationalism that was going on. And that idea of, you know, there's a very famous communist newspaper that's called The Internationalist. So it was kind of a little bit of a play on that at the time, which, not that we were communists, but it was the idea that we were kind of fighting back and using propaganda in the other way, in the reverse way to what was going on in the media, was kind of part of the idea as well. Right. I mean, aside from the fact that those images just looked awesome, they just were great arresting images. Mm. And I think the best artwork that we ever did.
Well, perhaps somebody said you look like Lennon and you probably got the wrong one, but that's fair enough. It's easy to do, right? All right, let's play some tracks off the album. Hindley Street, what a famous street in Adelaide that is. And there's some wonderful establishments in that street as well. What's the story behind this song?
We were staying on Hindley Street, and when I started writing that song, and we were on tour, and the song is about the idea that you can't get a good cup of tea anywhere
until you get to Alice Springs.
When you're on tour, until you get to the Todd Street Mall Cafe in Alice Springs, which is, you know, so hilarious and ridiculous. That's why it goes on to say nah, because it's a, you know, it's a ridiculous thing to be complaining about. 25 in 30 days was, we did 25 shows in 30 days around the country, and we were staying in hotels that were of dubious quality, and that's why the hotel decor shades were always poorly sewn. So that was, it was fun, that song. Yeah. That's all it was. And the key thing to the recording of that song was
the Titus Girls
coming in and just adding all of that fun to it. You can hear them laughing and yelling at each other and talking shit all the way through it. It's hilarious.
Which hasn't changed.
Next track is going to be Belter. What do we know about this song?
I think Belter was just supposed to be a massive song. I remember rehearsing this with Nick in the pre-production, and I suppose it's a little of a Beatles thing in a way, isn't it? It's got a real massive, like,
It was called Belter Smelter.
Belter Smelter, yeah, Helter Skelter. So, yeah, that's, so yeah, that's the influence on that one.
The next track is, I think, in my personal opinion, your finest song, because I love The Day You Come, because it's in equal parts full of hope and full of angst as well. It's a really interesting song. Can you tell me your thought process behind this one?
Well, musically, The Day You Come is Powderfinger at its essence. You know, it's everyone's character. It's the vibe of us being in a room together and creating what
it's
you
the
hear.
Marbo, Darren.
It's the Marbo.
I love how you're talking so softly too, yes. Darren. That's fantastic.
Using his constitution voice.
Yes. But it's the essence of the band, that song, to me.
I think it sums up that period especially perfectly, because it's got a little bit of adventure and it's serious, but it's fun and it's, I mean, I'd never used my voice that way before either, and that was a big change for us. And we kind of were concerned about releasing it as the first single. We didn't know how people would take it, but we backed it because we thought it was such a good song, and I think we were right in the end.
The next track is almost like the yin to the previous track's yang, or perhaps, you know, in a different order, and that would be Already Gone.
Already Gone was originally just conceived as a very Beatlesque song, and it's in fact the reverse of She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. That's where the melody originally came from, it was kind of an acoustic song, more like Across the Universe, and then the band got their hands on it and turned it into a really great pop rock song. What do you think about Already Gone, JC?
I love Already Gone, BF.
Wow. So if it's like the reverse, if it's the reverse
I'm
of the Beatles.
It today, aren't I? Yeah.
If it's the reverse really of the like Beatles, it. You know, play it backwards and it says Turn Me On Dead Man, apparently.
Yes.
That's it.
Passenger's the next song off the album, which of course was a big radio hit as well. Your thoughts on Passenger?
Passenger, I think that became Passenger's probably my Already Gone, that is to JC.
Hey, I didn't say anything, Darius.
It became a bigger song than I thought it was ever going to become personally. I bought the initial idea in on an acoustic guitar, and I kind of felt that that's what it needed to be. That's what it needed to be, kind of gentle and beautiful. And it turned into a kind of what we do, which is make things big but still, you know, pretty good and powerful. And again, the Titus Girls lent themselves to this song in an incredible way.
Yeah, and also I think one of the keys to this song is that Hoggy added a guitar melody to the outro section of it, which is do 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 do, which made it into something way better than it was prior to that. And I think that was one of the secrets about Hoggy's guitar playing, was that he had a knack for making these really simple melodies that were like great melodic hooks, like backing vocals or something. Almost,
absolutely.
And in the tradition of LPs, we're halfway through, so we're going to turn the record over and play the other side, which will bring us to Don't Want to Be Left Down. What can you tell us about this song?
I think this is one of the songs where you can see some of the influences coming through. You know, when I think of it, I think like sounds like the guitar sounds like a Dead Kennedys opening riff.
Oh, yeah.
It was originally called DK.
DK, yeah.
Song.
So,
that's what
I mean,
it was originally called.
As we were saying earlier, this is one of the instances where we sort of go into this sort of post-punk, or Powderfinger's version of post-punk, make it. So, I mean, that was the idea, have energy. And, I mean, even on the record, there's that AM, FM sort of stuff going through. So it's like almost like you change stations. And so this song was, I just remember being all about energy and had that real ethic of punkness and the best way we could do it.
Ryan. Next track is Good Day Ray. It's I like it. It rhymes and that's good. What's the story behind this one?
Well, Good Day was a piss take on G'day for some reason. I'm not sure why we used to say that, but we used to say Good Day to each other. Cogsy used to say that a lot, actually. But this was a song which was about Stuart Littlemore from Media Watch and the attacks that he used to make every Monday night on Ray Martin from A Current Affair. And that's why it's He's At You Again, Ray. He's testing out your headspace. And because it was relentless and it was hilarious. We were all avid watchers of Media Watch. We all thought it was really hilarious seeing the media being taken down. So,
who's Johnny? You right, Johnny?
It was you.
Is it me, is it?
Yeah.
Okay, right. I've never known that.
So there's in the middle of it, it's all right, you ready, Johnny? Okay, okay. before the song actually takes off. But, I mean, that was kind of part, that is an indicator of the spirit of the things that we were doing at the time. We were having a really good time. Like, something like that would never have happened on Odyssey number 5, where we were all really serious and it was all atmospheric and it was all kind of, it had kind of had a bit of an absence of humour by then.
The next Trading Places, which I presume isn't a nod to the, I think, Eddie Murphy film of the time?
It was, actually.
Really? Okay,
it
go on.
It certainly should be.
Okay.
Yeah, well, because I think one of the lyrics is "Trade my place" in there, so we all loved that movie. We thought it was hilarious. Dan Aykroyd as well, right?
That's yeah. Right. Yeah,
so that was where, that kind of probably starts to point to where we went with Odyssey number 5, that song where there's a lot of instrumentation. Mm. I remember when we were at Stanley Street and I remember sitting with a keyboard with Darren and we were kind of putting that arrangement for the strings and horns and stuff together just on a keyboard, yeah. Which ended up being obviously arranged properly by a string arranger and horn arranger and recorded properly as well. It'd be interesting to hear what that original demo was, actually, to see if that was any good,
and
how much it changed.
All right.
Yeah.
And, of course, the demo is available on the CDs, which we'll talk about that in a moment as well. The next track, two more to go, Private Man. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, I think Private Man was another one of those one of those songs that were influenced by earlier bands. I think at one stage I remember Hoggy and I we're trying to make it sound a bit more like The Cure. And when the keyboard, I think Darren and Bernard were trying to put some bluesy keyboard over the top of it, and I remember saying, that's not the way to go. To keep it sort of changed track. So yeah, this song's probably a bit of a, lyrically I don't, Bernard's probably best to talk about that, but the musically we were sort of trying to channel The Cure.
And was that early Cure?
And again,
I was going to say, sorry.
Yeah, like with around that, Primary and all
that. Yeah, Primary
sort of stuff,
and a forest and stuff like that. You can hear that in the bass line, can't you? Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
That's absolutely what it was. And and in the same way that Don't Want to Be Left Out was called DK, this song was called Smithy.
Smithy, yeah.
We've got one more track to play on the album, and that is Celebrity Head, which is a great staple for FM breakfast radio shows and, you know, benchmark competitions. What was the story behind Celebrity Head?
I have no idea how it became known as Celebrity Head, do you? I'm not sure where that comes from, but we were taking the piss out of the music press. Mm. You know, there was a lot of there's a lot of posturing that goes on in the music media, and we thought that it was worthwhile. You know, whenever you read a review, there's always this mention of it's their sophomore album, instead of why don't you just say it's their second album, you absolute tosspot.
And it's like when people say an album's dropped, gee, I hate that.
Yeah, and it's just that idea that people end up talking about themselves.
That's right.
And not talking about the music. They talk about their own personality. They could, you know, this song talks about how there were no parks. I couldn't even get a park. I was late.
That review we took it from was a Livid Festival, and I remember showing to the band that the reviewer made a review of the band from her living room because she wasn't even there, but they sounded good.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Talking
right,
about that. You know, do you remember how ridiculous is that? Don't even review it if you can't be there.
Yeah, so it was funny. Mm. It was supposed to be funny, but I think people took us really seriously as well. Like, people didn't realise that we were kind of trying to have some fun at the time. That might have fed into our later seriousness.
Right.
Not really sure.
It could be Powderfinger's version or, you know, a variation of Stereophonics' Mr. Writer. I don't know if you've ever heard that song from them, but that also has that same kind of angst. It's like, you know, you're getting the free trip, at least do the right thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
So there you go, that Celebrity Head. There's actually 13 tracks on the album. Time's got away from us. But if you want to pick up the album, it's blown out from the original 13 track. You've got 35 live on the re-release. You've got the live at the Wireless session, and you've got the B-sides on the album, and also there's Never Before versions as well. You've really collated and got together some fantastic stuff here, haven't you?
We've tried.
Yeah. We've done our absolute best to make a really, really good release. We kind of did it under the limited time. So we were able to kind of pull together as much as we could, just some demos that people would never have heard before, and one song called Feels Like Something, which was never heard before.
All right. 20th anniversary of Internationalist. Welcome news for fans who, of course, are still lamenting the passing of Powderfinger from a live sense. Will there be the possibility of a reunion at any stage?
Still no plans,
still
Phil.
No plans.
You never say never, Phil.
Yeah. I thought I'd have to ask.
Never say never, but well, that's no. It.
Well, you know, well, here's the thing. You've
they're opening a new venue in Brunswick Street. There you go.
Give it a plug, yeah, please. Yeah.
No, just for the band's going to get back together for that. Let's start that rumour.
Brilliant. Well, here's the thing. I'm kidding,
Phil. Yeah.
Hold on. I might declare some self-interest here. My name's John Collins. I just happen to be the...
I was just joking.
All right. It's okay. You're not testifying. It's all right. And of course...
I guess that's a no, fellas.
Well, you've mentioned Stanley Street, Vulture Street and Hindley Street. There's still 700 streets in Australia that you haven't actually given any credit to yet. Powderfinger, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks Phil.
Thanks, Phil.